Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. The Bible's offerings are oftentimes jarring visual lessons about the high cost moving humanity from far away from God's presence to near. This study walks through the what and the why of the burnt, grain, peace, sin, and guilt offerings in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7. We see how Malachi chapter 3 warns against tired, careless worship via these lessons. And we explore how Messiah Yeshua, Christ Jesus, uses parables in Luke chapter 6. These are the parables of blind guides, of log versus speck in the eye, of good fruit, of wise and foolish builders. These bring the same themes from Leviticus and Malachi into daily life: integrity, repentance, and restoring true peace with God and others.
Offerings that are starting off that we've been going through here in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7. And these offerings, there are several different categories of them. And one of the things that we take a look at is that these are not about barbecue, but they are about a relationship. Because as we remember, the offerings are translated from the term of korbanot. And korbanot comes from the Hebrew verb of karav. And karav means to approach or to draw near. So thus, the korban or the offering is that thing which draws near. So that's always important to remember, that the whole goal of all of these offerings, all of these korbanot, is to draw near. Draw near to what? We're drawing nearer to the presence of the Lord. That is what the lesson is, the pattern that was shown to Moses up on the mountain, that this is what heaven's goal is, to take those who are far off outside of where the tabernacle is, outside of the tabernacle gates, to bring them near to where the presence of the Lord is. That is what the whole intent of all of these different, these realms are. And one of the things that we see is that all of these things point forward, and after the time of Messiah, point backward to what the Messiah is as the ultimate korban, the ultimate offering, that thing which takes all of us who are far off from the presence of God and draws us near to the presence of God, brings us into the presence of God. As we see there in the letter to the Hebrews, through the veil into the presence of God, through that veil into the Holy of Holies, that Kadosh Kadashim, which we're going to see a lot of as we go through this discussion, the Holy of Holies. So, some of the other things that we see is that these are something that are not just something that was efficacious or something that did something at a point in time and they stopped doing something. One of the things that was communicated to Moses is, this is a pattern. Build it like you see the vision shown on the mountain. And you see that reflected in the letter of Hebrews. Hey, this is a pattern. This is, as it uses the term in the letter to the Hebrews, this is a shadow of things that were to come. Doesn't mean that, you know, as some translations put it, a mirror shadow or only a shadow. It is something that is a representation, a reminder, a teaching tool, a lesson that you walk through day by day by day, which is showing how what? Those who are far off are being brought near. That is what the whole focus of what the tabernacle is about. So as we move forward here, some key terms that we have, we already talked about the korban or the offering, but another key term that we come across in this passage is reach nichoach, and that is what's translated as the soothing or pleasing aroma to the Lord. Now that's a very interesting indicator, and as we've been going through these chapters of Leviticus, we've seen that mentioned often and talking that this is going to be a soothing or a pleasing aroma to the Lord. And Another key phrase that we just mentioned here recently was the Kodesh Kadashim, which is translated as most holy, or it is also used to the term for the, when we talk about the most holy place, that is the Kadosh Kadashim, or the most holy place. And you'll see that some of these offerings have been referred to as Kadosh Kadashim, or most holy. And one of the other aspects is that the person who is worshiping is to do the samicha, or to put his hand, or to lean against the head of the offering that he's going to bring in. And that is a whole part of what? Transferring a part of yourself to what it is you're leaning upon. So thus, when you see in the apostolic writings, when I talk about laying on of hands, it is a leaning on, a bestowing from one person to another of who you are to them. So thus, when it talks about, you know, about being cautious about laying on of hands too hastily, that's a whole part of it, because, you know, you are, in the biblical sense, you know, transferring a bit of you to the person you're putting your hands upon. So it's not something in the biblical framework, and not something to be taken lightly. So as we move forward, we've got the main, as we start out, the class of offerings called the olah, or it's often translated as the burnt offering, or the whole burnt offering, or the ascending offering, because olah means to go up. So that is a phrase that's used there. Now, who is offering it? Now, for the rich people, people with means, they're going to be offering a bull. But for others, they're going to be offering a male sheep or a goat. And for the poor, their olah offering is going to be birds. And one of the things that you'll see, that there's also these that are offered daily, a daily tamid, or a continual offering, and offering on the different of the moedim, or the festivals. And it is to be a male without blemish. Now, how much? Well, it's to be an entire animal, except the skin, which, strangely enough, it's the hide is for the priests. Now, the priests, well, what do they do with hides? Well, that's why we often get a lot of parchment and other things that come from hides of animals. But this whole thing is to be burned on the altar after you're going to be sprinkling the blood. And some of when you talk about what's the reason, because that's one of the things we should be always zeroing in on, is what is the lesson? These are all supposed to be lessons that are going to draw you near to the presence of God. So this is about a voluntary devotion, because all of you is going up. That is going to be a part of the visual lesson, that you yourself is going up, entirely up. That is really a full surrender. And then it talks about there in Leviticus 1:4, that's going to be accepted on your behalf as an atonement. So that you are, yes, Lindsay. Lindsay has a question over here. I find it fascinating. Yeah.
That the skin is not to be burned. Oh. And when you say we're offering as a visual, we're offering ourselves up, but not our flesh.
Not the outward part, yes. Burning up the inward parts. Yeah, good observation on that. Yeah, and when you talk about the sanctity, or how set aside this is, it's talked about as holy, but not always labeled as a Kodesh, Kadashim, or the most holy. But yes, its blood and its flesh are something that covers or makes atonement. Now, as far as eating it, none for the worshiper or the priest, the Kohen, is, it's all going to be ascending. It is to be a, that's a whole part of that's Riach Nichoach, or the soothing aroma to the Lord. And one of the things that you see about pointing forward to the Messiah, this is about offering up everything, going all in. So next class we have is the mincha offering. Another one often talked about as a grain or a meal or a tribute offering. This is part of what Pamela was asking about here before. And you'll see that they're kind of divided up into some different categories of the mincha offering. But it's talked about there in Leviticus 2 and also in chapter 6, verses 14 through 18, and part of the passage we looked at today. So who is offering this? These are individuals, but often goes along with an olah offering. It's to be a fine flour with oil and frankincense, but no leaven or honey. So again, nothing, no fomenting corruption and no honey or sweetness that goes along with it. Baked, fried, etc., but the poor could offer this as well. And how much of it? There was that memorial portion that was to be coming off of it and burned it with frankincense, and the remainder of what was left over then went to the priests. Now, when we talk about the reason for it, it's mentioned as a thanksgiving offering. Thanks. So if you're thankful for what the Lord has done for you, that you're dedicating your labor or what you've produced, or you're expressing your loyalty to God. So this is something that is expressing that which comes from, when you talk about grain, it's something that's growing and building. So what has the Lord built or grown within your life? And that thankfulness that you have for that bounty that has come through what the Lord has grown. And so as far as how set aside this is one of those categories that is Kodesh Kadashim, or most holy. And that remainder is most holy. So it's eaten only by the priests and in a holy place. So when they're going to be eating it, they're going to be eating it in the confines of where the tabernacle or temple is. And that's another one of those few offerings where when it touches something, it's conferring holiness for it. So that's very interesting. So when you're talking about having joyfulness for what the Lord has brought to you, that is something that when it's offered up, it conveys a set apart something to something else. And we can see that, you know, when they talk about even in the secular world, they recognize that. What is the big thing everybody talks about these days? Gratitude. You always have to have gratitude, the attitude of gratitude all the time. And rather than being, you know, thankful to the universe, which has no power or agency to do anything, rather we should be thankful to the one who made the universe, the one who made everything that develops and grows things within us. And that, you could say, just like conferring that sense of holiness, conveying that kind of thankfulness to other people for the things that the Lord has done. What does that do? It's infectious. It can get that sense of gratitude to other people. And if other people become grateful for what the Lord has done for them, what then has happened? Like sowing seed. You know, we're talking about a grain offering. This is like, you know, it's now gone off and formed other plants that are now growing up in what the Lord is doing. So, and you see that in the lesson there of the Messiah, that, you know, Messiah being offered up as someone who's a sinless life. So none of that, the chametz or the yeast or the leaven that's in there, and none of the honey that is in there of the sweetness, but that's a pure life. And who is then eating it? Well, the priests get a little bit of the rest of it with this unleavened. They're eating it in a holy place, but no, the worshiper is not going to be taking a part of this. So this is just the priesthood that is eating this up. So moving on here to the Zevach Shelamim, or often just called the Shelamim offering. So that sacrifice of peace, or the peace offering, who's offering that? Another voluntary one. It's about being thanksgiving, or if you're doing a vow along with a vow, or it's a free will offering, comes from the herd or from the flock, male or female. But yes, it is again to be unblemished as the other offerings that you bring. How much of it? Well, these are the ones where Remember that day we were talking all about kidneys and hearts and all that stuff, and with those symbols as they show up in scripture a lot? Well, this, as we talked about at that time, yeah, this is where this shows up a lot. Talked about in Leviticus 3 and Leviticus 7, verses 11 through 34. But fat, kidneys, and burned up as a food offering. And then the breast of the animal is then waved, and the right thigh goes to the priests. And the rest then goes to the offerer and to the family, and then is eaten communally. So thus, when you talk about the shalomim, or a shalom offering, where you're reaching a point of contentment and well-being, where things have worked out and are settled. So, reasons here, it's fellowship. You're eating a meal here together. Thanksgiving, joy, peace with God and others. And again, talked about also as a riach nechoach, or a soothing aroma that is going up. Now, we talked about it when we were going through this before in Leviticus 3, but there has been discussion as to what is a Pesach, or a Passover offering. What is it? Is it a sin offering, or is it a shalomim offering? And people have debated it, and the answer is yes. Yeah, it's got a little bit of both in there together. It's unique in and of itself, but it has mixtures of both. It is mixtures of a little bit of a sin offering, because it's covering the doorposts, but and blocking. But it is also a shalomim offering, where you're eating it communally together. And it is also something of saying, hey, we have reached contentment and well-being for that household. And you remember the original account of the Passover, that was during the 10th plague. So instead of the destroyer coming into that household and going after the firstborn in that household, the destroyer would pass over or pass by, skip, or limp at the door. It was blocked by the blood of the Pesach, the blood of the Passover on the door. So this particular, the shalomim offering, is talked about as not, it's holy, but it's not as a kodesh kadashim, like the sin or the guilt offering, when we'll get to here coming up. Because why? It's celebrated and eaten together communally. So it's not to be set aside only there in the temple courtyard, but it is something to be eaten by families together. So thus you can see why that is. The Passover meal kind of fits in a couple of different categories there, because it is something that is a celebration together. So as we move on here further, we've got the chatat offering, and that is the sin or the purification offering. And that's who is bringing it. It is a person who has unintentional sins. That's the key point here. This is unintentional sins, whether it be individuals or leaders or the whole congregation or the high priest who's involved with this. And there's different levels of the offering by who's bringing it. A priest or the congregation is going to be bringing a bull or goat or a sheep for the leader, and birds or flour for the poor who can't afford more. And talking about how the blood is either sprinkled around various places of the sanctuary, or and then, of course, the fat is burned up from the fat of the sin offering, and the remainder is taken outside the camp, and if that's for the case of the high priest or the congregation, or if it's in other cases, then it's eaten by the priests. So depending on the level of it, if it is something that's referring to the high priest or the congregation, it becomes sort of toxic waste, so to speak, or you have to take it outside the camp. So thus, like we were talking about before, what is Yeshua? Is that a sin offering or is it a peace offering? We see, okay, there's elements of the sin offering here. So thus you have, when the Apostle Paul talks about Yeshua as a chatat or a sin offering, And you see hints of that also in Isaiah 53. That's where you can say, indeed, yeah, that fits in there as well. So there have been some quibbles over the centuries as to saying, well, no, it wasn't a sin offering, you know. But like we're saying, this Yeshua is not like a one part where you fit it. This is only fits here, and if it's there, if it's here. There are, as we talked about before, with the sin offering, Yeshua with the Messiah covers a whole bunch of different categories, because like we see in John chapter 1, where John the Baptist says, hey, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. We see that there is the element of Passover, Lamb of God, takes away the sins of the world, Yom Kippur, Day of Atonement. So is he the Passover or is he the Yom Kippur goats? Yes. Yes. So again, the answer is yes. So yeah, it becomes one of those things that when you see the apostle talking about all things are yes in the Messiah, you can start seeing why. Is because it's not just one thing, it's not just another thing. This is a complete picture of a pattern. So all of these elements together are communicating what the Lord is doing. So what is the whole point of all of this? For those who are far off to be brought near. So thus, when you see the apostles and you see in the Gospels, when it talks about that being what the Messiah is doing, to take those who are far off, those who are lost, and bringing them, finding them, and bringing them home, that is the role of heaven, and that is the role of Messiah. Then he talks about Yeshua saying, I'm here to do my Father's will. We see that that is the will of heaven, is to bring those who are lost to those who are far off, to bring them near. And that is what the good news is. You see there in Genesis 12, where it starts developing, hey, this is something that is not just for one family, one guy, in one place, but this is for all the whole world. But God is forming like this beachhead, so to speak, or this place where he's going to start working, and then it's going to grow outward into all the world. Kind of like what Yeshua talked about, the kingdom of heaven being like, you know, the woman who had the leaven and mixed it into dough, and then it developed and mixed through all of the dough. And that's kind of a lesson, a preview of coming attractions for Shavuot, because that's one of the key lessons as to why you start with leavened bread at the front end of the count up to Shavuot, and you end with leavened bread at the end of the count at Shavuot. Why you start with leavened at the beginning and, or unleavened at the beginning and leavened at the end of it. Yes. So with the chatat, the reasons here is that you're purifying it, you're cleansing it from this sin where it's gone off course, and you're bringing this atonement for the specific unintentional violations. And so it's taking that which is not holy, not set apart, and making it now set apart again, setting it back on its course to be set apart for the purpose of what God is intending. So thus you see, like in language there in Romans chapter 8, verse 3, where you see that's talking about that Yeshua is that sin offering. So now on to the last category there of the Asham offering. Talked about there in Leviticus 5, verses 14 through chapter 6, verse 7, and then also in the first 10 verses of chapter 7 of Leviticus. This Asham offering is also called the guilt or the reparation or trespass offering, depending on your translation. Now, who is bringing it? These are for sins that, as we have talked about here just recently, these are sins involving some sort of sacrilege, or you're not treating things that are set apart for God's purposes with the kind of respect that is involved with that. You weren't paying attention to treating things with respect. or you were engaged in a false oath, or you're trying to harm other people. We were talking about defrauding other people, withholding things that you were supposed to give back to them, like, you know, their deposits or things like that. So those kinds of breaches. Now, for with this, that's you were to be offering a ram without blemish, plus the restitution, and that which is talking about, so it ends up being 120% of the value of whatever this harm was that you were bringing. So whatever it was, you add 20% or 1/5 on top of that, and that is what you were bringing. Because that demonstration that we often got as children, I don't know if you got it, but I got it a few times where, you know, if you muck something up or mess something up, then you had to put in some extra effort on top of it to then bring some restitution. And I know in a couple of cases, I learned the lesson, okay, because it took out more of me than I got from it, so to speak. Then, okay, maybe I should be a little bit more watchful about trying to do something like that in the future. So, and this Asham offering is one of those categories that is the Kodesh Kadashim, or most holy. It's eaten by the priest there in the holy, in a holy place there in the confines. So worshipers not taking a part of this. And thus, when you see the parallels there with the Messiah, yeah, this is a part of saying you are not just covering over it, because that's what the sin offering does, but you're restoring. So that's why it's a very important part of the process that you have a sin, but then also a guilt offering. Because guilt is saying what? Oh, there is a debt that is hanging over my head. What am I going to do with this debt? Am I just going to forget about it? And so, okay, oopsie, and just walk on as this debt's hanging out there. Or do we say, nope, I did it. I have this debt, and I'm going to take care of this debt. And I will do what I can to rectify that. So thus, you see, like, in the case of where, remember in the Gospels, where you see that Yeshua is going through and he meets the tax collector, Zacchaeus, and you see that he has that turnaround and he realizes, oh, I have been astray. I have been far off. Even though he had a front row seat there to the kingdom of God, he'd been far off, but he saw that Yeshua is saying, hey, I want to eat in your house. So here he is saying the kingdom of heaven is drawing near to him. Well, what is he going to do? He said, hey, if I have done what? I've defrauded anybody. He then pays restitution. He's going to, does he just go 20%? No, he goes well beyond the 20%. So basically he's saying, yeah, I've been guilty for these things, but I'm going to make restitution well and beyond what it is that heaven might say as the bare minimum. Because why? He was overjoyed that he who had been far off is now being brought near and saying, nope, I'm not going to be continuing to go this way anymore. So that's the core of it. These, the sweet savor ones where you had that riach nechoach, or the sweet savor, the soothing aroma, those include the olah, the mincha, and the shelamim offering. Those are talking about devotion or worship. What all of you is being gone up in smoke. Those non-sweet offerings like the chatat and the asham offerings, or the sin and the guilt offerings, those focus on what? Cover up the problem and do what? Purify and then restore the one who's involved. So you've got the one of you yourself are getting consumed up. Those are the ones where there's a sweet aroma. But then the ones that need to be covered and you need to deal with and then purify and restore the situation, those then are a part of the cleanup crew. And then, thus, when you have the parts of that that are most holy, that grain remainder, the sin or the guilt offering, those are there to sustain the priesthood and are saying, hey, these are set aside for the Lord. But the pattern about this is about substitution. Except for the grain offering, which, you know, you might say that the innocent kernels of grain that get ground up or whatever made into flour. But where you have taught animals involved, animals did nothing, yet they were the ones picked and they suffer because of the things that we have done. So thus the lesson of that, as gruesome as that is that we have gone far off. And it takes then one who wasn't responsible for doing any of that to come in and fix the problem, to bring those who are far off, to bring them close to and bring them near. And when we're talking about like restitution and just bringing the offerings in general, yeah, there is something we've got to move from where we are. We have to move from where we are and actually say we are going to change. Thus, that's where you get that in the letter to James. There in the apostle Yaakov says, hey, it's one thing where you can say you'll be warm and well fed and whatever, but what? If you truly believe and trust in what God says, you're going to do what? Actually act. Not just talk, but act. Your what the change that's inside of you is going to then go into action. So that's a whole part of where you're talking about these free will offerings and such. There is a change within you that has prompted action that then comes forward. So thus, one of the things that we see here is the pattern then reaches its fullness with Yeshua the Messiah, who's both the offering and the high priest to bring this. So then when we get over, and we talked about this last week, that you have this progression where it changes from the first five chapters of Leviticus, where you get the burnt offering, the grain offering, the peace, the sin, and the guilt offering. Then the order switches around where you've got the burnt offering, the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, then it ends with the peace offering. And that is in chapters 6-7. That is what the priests walk the people through. And why is the whole purpose of that? Is you are teaching then that you burnt offering goes up. Grain offering, that things which the Lord produces, goes up. Sin, guilt, covered over, restored. And then what are you ending with? Peace. We're ending with shalom between heaven and earth and between us and other people. That is where we end up with. So that's when you see like in Matthew chapter 5, we're in the midst of the Sermon on the Mount where Yeshua is saying, hey, if you've got something against someone has something against you and you're presenting your offering, a lot of signs say that you're talking about a shalomim offering here, this peace offering. If you're there talking about, hey, everything is cool, yet there is still some sort of thing that someone has against you, go and fix that. Go and rectify that. Try to seek reconciliation. It may not happen, but like what the Apostle Paul says, as far as it pertains to you, live at peace with other people. Seek shalom. Be peacemakers, as the Messiah puts it. Blessed are the peacemakers. Yeah. Happy are the peacemakers. So thus, try to make peace. May not work, but that is what we should always be seeking for. So be peacemakers, not bomb throwers. So that's one of the goals that we should have in the kingdom. So that's when we look at Malachi. One of the lessons that we have of the passage that we looked at in Malachi, a short little passage there, and it's a relatively short book. But one of the messages that we have is, for these were people who were wrecked. These are the returns from exile. We talked about this a little bit earlier when we were kind of doing a overview there of Nehemiah and Ezra, or Nehemiah and Ezra. And we were looking at those who returned and the crisis they were going through of, you were dealing with a bunch of neighboring peoples who don't want you there, and to try to keep the your coalition of people together. So this message here of the prophet Malachi, thought to be written kind of after that period of Ezra and Nehemiah. So it's trying to get the community of Jerusalem, you got the wall rebuilt, and you're trying to get that reestablished. And so you've got the temple been rebuilt here, but interestingly enough, it's kind of like when you look at the Exodus and you wonder, okay, you've just gone through the Exodus and the crossing of the Red Sea. And then right on the other side, after a few days, what happens? Start complaining. And a similar thing, you know, you think you've just been saved out of exile. You were thought that you were lost in a foreign land. The Lord brings you back, you know, one of your captive emperors gets messages to then go and rebuild your temple and rebuild your walls of your capital city. And then in the centuries after that, it just starts going downhill. And thus you see where the prophet there is talking to a people that have just kind of lost enthusiasm. And you can see how that happens, where you can have a revival. We might have looked at revivals here in this area or in this country. And decades later, maybe not even a decade later, enthusiasm just goes right downhill. So you see that the prophet Malachi earlier on, he's talking about that the priests are offering defective. We were talking about, hey, it's supposed to be unblemished. The priesthood was like, whatever comes through, I'll take the good ones and leave the ones. I'll take those over to the temple. And so one of the things that you see is that daddy is getting the belt out and bringing the condemnation through the prophet and saying, this is what the problem is. And thus, what you see in the book is then the people respond, and then you see God's reply. And that's, as we see how it ends the book, you see that day of the Lord, and then the prophecy that we all know right at the end of Malachi is where you've got that prophecy that there will be, right around the day of the Lord, there'd be one coming, and that is the great sending of Eliyahu. And then we see that coming in the spirit and power of Eliyahu with Yochanan or John the Baptist coming. So with this in Malachi 3, you see that this is really continuing on with these challenges or chastisements for the priesthood about just really phoning it in. They didn't care, and they were just going through the motions. And then, you know what happens when you have leadership that doesn't care or such? It just trickles right downhill. Yeah, everybody else doesn't care either. Yeah. So one of the things that's foretold is that there would be a coming messenger who is going to prepare the way. And it's interesting when you see in the Targums, which are the Aramaic translations that were written right about the first to third centuries AD. So this is after the first century, that in this passage, when it talks about the Memra is going to come, that this Memra, or the word, as it is there in Aramaic, that the word was the messenger was going to come, but then wrapped up also that the Memra and the Lord were going to come here together. So that's setting up what you see the expectation and the realization there, as it talks about in John chapter 1, where it talks about the Word became flesh. And that word there represented, if it was in Aramaic, and the Aramaic translations that came later, that would be Memra, that the Word of the Lord. So, thus, what you're seeing in Malachi chapter 3 is that this is going to be a refinement for the priests. They are going to be refined. And it talks about fire. The fire was going to come and refine the priests. And so thus, that's why the parallel here is with the passage that we saw in Leviticus, is that this fire that was on the altar that was there for the olah, the everything gets burned up offerings, that was to not go out. And it's interesting that when it talks about there, and then the New American Standard talks about translation, do not let it go out. The word there is actually kava, which means do not quench it. It's the same word that's used elsewhere in the prophets where it talks about quenchable, unquenchable fire that the Lord says he's going to send and to burn things up with unquenchable fire. This is the same message here for this fire that's put on there. Basically, you do not put it out. You priests do not put this out. Well, one of the things you could say, well, you can put things out by doing what? Inattentiveness. You're not paying attention and it goes out. You know, that's like the great proverb that my dad likes to quote a lot. What is it? For want of wood, the fire goes out. And for that's in the context of a number of things, one of which is that when they talk about pouring gasoline on a fire, that if you do not feed a conflict, then it will go out on its own. So thus the corollary for that with the priesthood is your job is to keep the thing burning, to keep the lamps going on the menorah. And if you don't do your job, what happens? The lamps go out. The fire goes out. And here you see the prophet Malachi is talking to priesthood that are doing what? They're basically letting the fire go out, so to speak, because they just phonied it in. Didn't really care. And one of the things they're talking about is not only just the priesthood's weariness, but also the people's weariness. And so the call then is to what? Teshuva, teshuv, turn around. So you're going one way, let's go back the other way. So thus, you see this rebuke. And a lot of what is talked about there, we had defective offerings, neglected support of the priests, and the resulting unholy worship, that was a part that was supposed to get turned around. Tammy has got a comment or a question over here.
Yeah, in some ways, the priests were kind of shooting themselves in the foot by accepting inappropriate offerings. They were causing this cycle of indifference, because the Torah says that when the people bring the offerings to them, they're supposed to live off of those offerings. So when people were bringing in blemished animals, you know, since the Levites lived in big cities or whatever, they didn't necessarily have their own ability to raise flocks. So when these people were bringing in diseased animals or defective animals that maybe couldn't breed or anything, that caused hardship for the Levites. So the Levites were kind of shooting themselves in the foot by accepting defective offerings, not only because it caused the people to be indifferent and presume that that was okay, but also how are they going to support themselves with animals that were defective, maybe not able to reproduce or whatever the situation might have been.
Yeah. So thus you can see where the spiritual lessons come in this, is that if you have a bit of inattentiveness in what you're doing, you may think, it's just easier this way. But it snowballs. It'll snowball. Time after time, it'll start going downhill. You'll let other things slide. You'll let other things slide. And then this slides. And then that slides. You know, and so people will often talk about, the fallacy of the slippery slope. Well, one of the things I always like to talk about people is that I heard once some great rabbi was talking about the spiritual gravity, and basically we know what gravity is here, but spiritual gravity works in a very similar way, that if you don't act against the force that's pulling you down, what will happen? You'll fall down. You know, if you, I'm here standing because there is all of the muscles and tendons and everything else is working against gravity, which is going to pull me down. Because if I just kind of let go, what's going to happen? I'm going to fall over on the floor. So all of us are working against this spiritual gravity. And thus, when you talk about the slippery slope, what is one of the things we learned in physics? That an object in motion will stay in motion until what? Acted upon by an outside force. So thus you're talking about the slippery slope. If you got a force that's dragging it down, if there's nothing acting against it, what's going to happen? It will continue. It will continue on. So thus you can see what happens with the slippery slope is, and you see the biblical term for it is called backsliding, is that we can slide downward if we are not paying attention. And we just let this go, and we let that go. There's often the lesson that you get of in Deuteronomy when we get to that part where it talks about that if you treat the Lord with casualness or indifference, the Lord will treat you with casualness and indifference. Basically, apathy. If you are apathetic towards the Lord and towards his instructions, the Lord will be apathetic towards you. And that is something that you see where the prophet is really getting at. So let's kind of close things out here and switch over to our passage there in Luke, where we are catching a little bit here of the, it's called the Sermon on the Sermon on the Plain, which covers this little passage there in Luke chapter 6. And in this section, we see that Yeshua is teaching about, it's, you know, seems like several disconnected images, but really they are connected together. And these images and parables, which are talking about how to be discerning, to distinguish one from the other, and to also how to examine yourself. And thus, when you're examining yourself and you have correcting on what you see within yourself, thus you can live with integrity. Because what is one of the lessons you have of integrity? Like when we talk about structural integrity, that means what? It is doesn't have weaknesses in it where it's going to fall down. So thus, within us, if we have spiritual integrity, what does that mean? There are the weaknesses in us that will make us fall down. So thus, in this passage, we see there's the parable of the blind guides there in Luke 6:39, the teacher and the pupil in Luke 6:40, the speck and the log in Luke 6, verses 41 and 42, the tree and the fruit in Luke 6, verses 43 through 45, and closing out with the two builders in Luke chapter 6, verses 46 through 49. So taking a look first at the blind guides one, where it talks about, you know, a blind man cannot guide a blind man, can he? Will they not both fall into the pit? And falling to the pit, we saw it with in our passage in Malachi. A pit is just not a falling into the big potholes that we have here in Sonoma County in the roads. This is talking about the abyss. And the abyss in Hebrew thought was, that is talking about the open grave where all bad things fall into. This is not just a hole in the ground. This is a very big moral downfall. So when it talks about blind leading the blind, and if they both fall into the pit. So basically, it is a big warning to us about who it is that we are listening to. And, you know, today we've got the a lot of voices out there to listen to and to be really careful. And we use the various tests that we have in Scripture, like in Deuteronomy 13 and 18, about testing prophets and testing spirits and, you know, what they're saying, if it lines up with what the Word of God says, you know, and to be very, very careful about those voices that come along. Because really, if we don't have a clear vision, then whoever is leading can lead other people right into the abyss. The next little parable, the teacher and the pupil, their pupil is not above his teacher, but everyone after he's been fully trained will be like his teacher. So it's a dual lesson there. It's basically saying, hey, don't elevate yourself up above your teacher, but the goal of the teacher is to do what? To basically replicate himself or self into the pupil so that that person, the student, will become what? As it says, fully trained to do the task that the teacher is putting forward to. So, and we see, you know, we just went through Passover recently and we read the passages where Yeshua was saying, hey, if they're going to take it out on me, they're going to take it out on you. That's a whole part of where the teacher and student comes in. So a whole part of the lesson is to say, yeah, this is a part of what the kingdom of God is all about. And these troubles will come upon us. Because why? The adversary hates the kingdom. And that whole message of the kingdom, to take those who are far off, to draw them near, to draw them near, and to form this bond and relationship with humanity, to restore what the where it was like in the Garden of Eden. So, and you see the where it talks about the speck and the log. You know, why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye? Do you not notice the log that is in your own eye? So basically the idea is that, hey, if you have a clear vision to see yourself, that you may have some of the foibles that you're trying to correct in other people. So make sure that if you, before you go off and try to correct somebody else, that you yourself are not having some of the same problems. I know that in my daily work, if I'm frustrated with some of my coworkers, I have to examine myself. And if I poke hard enough, I realize, yeah, I've got some of those same problems that I'm trying to criticize someone else about. Yeah, so that is a really, that's a hard realization to realize. You know, it's easy to get frustrated at other people, but then it's really difficult to realize that other people can have that same frustration with you because you're behaved exactly the same way or doing exactly the same things. Yes, that old aphorism there about pointing fingers. Yes, Carrie has got a comment or a question over here.
Along with what you're saying, I think a lot of times we see the word hypocrite and we think, oh, no, we're not being a hypocrite. But the fact of reality is that we wouldn't be frustrated with that other person if we didn't already have the same problem. Mm. Because like attracts like that way, so every single time we're being that way, we're being a hypocrite, whether we like to admit it or not. Mm.
That's a good observation. All right. And the tree and the fruit. It talks about, for there is no good tree which produces bad fruit, nor on the other hand, bad tree which produces good fruit. For each tree is known by its fruit, which in some cases, we'll run into other philosophies that are out there in the world that people are best if they are a mixture of light and darkness together. Mixture of light and darkness together, and that is what makes a whole person. So, thus, you see that kind of a quandary is like, well, is it, can someone who is partly bad produce good fruit? And one of the things that you could see is where you see other parts in the gospel, you can see partly yes, where you see Yeshua chastises some of the some of those scribes, people who know the ways of God, and he says, hey, others will come into the kingdom, but you yourself won't get in. So you could say, well, that would be a bad tree. But there was some good fruit that came off the tree But did it help the tree? No. In the end, the master will cut it down. We'll cut the bad trees down. There might be some other fruit that comes off of it that will help somebody else, but that tree itself won't survive. So that's a good lesson in us, and that's a lesson that we've talked about over time with this big 50-cent word called syncretism that shows up in Israel's history, where they took a little dab of all kinds of beliefs of the surrounding nations and kind of mixed them in together with the worship of the God of Israel and blended into a nice little spiritual smoothie and sucked it down and thought, hey, this is great. They got little practices we like, you know, some characteristics of the deities that we like and mixed them all together, even brought them into the temple. And in the end result, what was that whole tree was cut down. So thus, you say, oh, it's a very, very difficult thing to then be mixing things together onto the same tree. Because there might be a part of the harvest that survives, but the tree itself will not. So that is one of those lessons to us about thinking, oh, we can just have a toe over here into the things of light and a toe into the things of darkness. It kind of gives us a little edge, you know. Have a little bit of darkness in there. But one of the things that you have to be careful with is that just like we were talking about with the offerings and kind of letting things slide over time, you can see that that little line of darkness will start moving around and you won't even notice it. You know, the old proverbial frog and boiling in the pot, but the lesson comes in is that you will see those things moving in your own life and just not even notice it until, hey, there's a lot more darkness in our life than we thought. We thought we could kind of keep it 50-50 and kind of keep one part of our life in the light and one part of our light in the darkness. But in time, we find out, no, you start getting, as we use another big 50-cent word, desensitized to the darkness. And start seeing, the darkness isn't so bad. You know, did God really say that we shouldn't have a little bit of darkness in our life, you know? So thus, when we're talking about the fruits of the Spirit and the fruits of the flesh, then you start seeing what is referred to. If you have a tree that is mostly fruits of the flesh, what kind of tree you're going to start calling it? It's a fleshly tree. So we kind of close things out here with the parable of the two builders. And it's interesting that it starts out with, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and you do not do what I say? And then he goes into this parable talking about person who builds and then what they build upon and the ones who building on the rock. It's a very interesting thing that you see a similar thing in the prophets talking about. Hey, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Because why? They were proud that they had the house, the dwelling place of the Lord in their midst. But they were in a very similar situation that we saw like in Malachi. The Lord... His house was there, but they didn't care. They were more obsessed about their position rather than their actual role. And thus, you see where the Lord is talking about, no, you've made this a den of robbers. You are ending up robbing not only God, but also the people, depriving them of what their true wealth is, and that is the Lord's presence. And so thus, no surprise, you see the similar message goes to Malachi that he's giving there about the tithes and the offerings. Bring the full tithes in. Don't skim off the top. Don't be diverting things off. When the people are bringing their stuff in, bring it all in. Because why? The priests were to do what? Live off of the tithes. Part of that was for them. So thus, if you're skimming off of what was supposed to be for the sport of the priesthood, what are you not doing? Trusting that the Lord will provide enough for you. You want a little bit more. So you just gotta take a little bit of a tax on the front end. You just got to be a little personal tax on the front end on the tithe before it gets into the official books and skim it off. You see a similar thing. That's what where you see the tax collectors in the time of the Gospels were doing exactly the same thing. They'd take a little commission off of the taxes that they would collect. And yeah, so sometimes it still happens here today. But thus, when you talk about that in this particular parable, okay, they're saying, Lord, Lord, just like those people in centuries before that were saying, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. But what were they building their trust and their work upon? Was it the rock? The Tzur Yisrael, the rock of Israel, the one who took them out of the house of bondage into the land of freedom? Were they building it upon that? No. Yeah, they were building it upon sand. It was something that had no anchor because they were bringing in other deities that weren't deities at all. So thus, there was no actual rock that they were building on. It was just sand. So whenever the calamities would come, what would those houses that were built on the sand do? As the parable talks about, fall down. You know, when you see that happening in the hillsides around here, whether you're up in Fountain Grove or down in Marin County, that there you got hillsides that move all the time. And in places where you're like, it's good enough. You know, if you don't take the effort to sink it all the way down into whatever bedrock you can find in some areas, when the hillside starts moving, what happens to your house? It goes right down there with it. So thus another lesson of what it is we put our house upon. What is it that we build our house upon? Yeah, so thus, as we come to the end of this, hope we can see that one of the key lessons that we get through all this pattern of bringing us from where we are far off into bringing us close to the presence of God is a whole part of refining us, burning up all of us that needs to be consumed so that in the end that we become a riach nechoach or a sweet aroma, that what goes up from us, it is a sweet aroma. Any last thoughts or questions here? Lindsay's got a thought or question down here. Pertaining to the last statement, yeah?
Say that when they fast, it could be a pleasing aroma to the Lord because we're burning fat.
Oh, fasting and burning fat. Well, that's an interesting idea. One of the ancient thoughts about with the fat, why you don't eat the fat and that offering up is when you barbecue, what is one of the things that you see with fat? Yeah, it causes flare-ups. It can cause things to burn higher. So one of the ancient ideas is that fat is basically a fire accelerator. And thus, it accelerates the fire on that. And that's a part of what one of the lessons of offering up the fat is that you want whatever it is to be going up to go up even faster and brighter and higher and with more vigor. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought up that about that idea of fasting, because when we get around to Yom Kippur time, we talk about that in the reference of that the Hebrew word of ana, which means to humble yourself, which is to basically to make yourself lower in that. And a whole part of making yourself lower is that you see what? Other people who are lower. Which is why in Isaiah 58, you see, hey, this is the fast that I call for, that you look for the widows and you see the orphans and you see the strangers, those are in prison. Because when the point of crushing yourself down is to then be able to see also other people who are oppressed as well. Oppressing yourself so that you can see other people who are oppressed. And then on Yom Kippur, you oppress yourself and you see, oh, here is the one who is taking my oppression away, who's taking my sins, my transgressions, my iniquities that were pressing me down, oppressing me, and removing them from us and taking them outside the camp and to be gone. God considers that gone. So yeah, great, great observation. Any other thoughts or comments here as we close out? All right. Carrie, yes.
Rewinding just a little bit, but there was one part a little earlier where we were talking about if we're apathetic toward God, he'll be apathetic towards us.
Mm, yes.
I think sometimes that can seem like the effect of it. I'm not sure if I could call God apathetic ever. But I do think it's important for us to understand our responsibility when we separate ourselves from him. You know, and I think that I think possibly what more happens is God is just set apart, just, you know, of himself. And then it's our responsibility to really align ourselves back with him when we step away.
And that's a great point, because what you're talking about is a great illustration of what the punchline of Acts chapter 10 is that to take those who are at the base level, the common, to lift them up. And that is what the whole lesson is, that God is taking those who are far off or those who are common and lifting them up to his level, to make them holy, to set them apart. So yeah, that's a great observation. Yeah. Any other great thoughts? Anne?
But the idea of the flame that is the eternal flame.
Yeah, Ish Tamid.
Pentecost is coming. And I think about the little flames that went on the apostles. Did they walk around with the little fire going as they went out? I mean, actually, we are, the flame is in us, you know, whether we let that fire keep on burning, you know, like the old song, keep that fire burning in my heart. Yeah. Keep it. That little light of mine is the same thing.
Yeah, and that's why you'll often see. You'll hear the term like Esh Tamid or continual fire or burning, and that comes from a little Hebrew play on words there, because it might be good to just talk about this on Shavuot, but here the Esh for fire is spelled Aleph and Sheen, and for man, it's Aleph Yod Sheen. And for woman, it's Aleph Sheen He. And so you see a lot of ancient commentators to say, oh, look at that. You know, you've got Ish for man, Isha for woman, and Ish for fire. Oh, look at all that there together. And so that's, you know, that's what you'll see, like a lot of medieval commentaries will make these connections between like the fire that burns between man and woman as being this continual fire. So that's why, and thus also into that idea of God's fire burning and consuming within us. So that's why you'll see like Chabad, their main website there is Aish for fire, because that's that idea of the continual burning in there. So yeah, great, great observation. So that's when we talk about the fire that God ignites within us. That's an interesting idea of then what is the fire that God is ignited there in those there on that particular Shavuot that's recorded in Acts chapter 2.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.